My name is Andy Hyde. I work for a company called RailPros. We do civil engineering for the railroads. And I run the IT stuff. Server. All the ones and zeros happy. They keep the employees happy. Then I want to introduce Matt Ball. Matt Ball comes with a foundation of marketing and development in the film industry with an emphasis in special event projects, stage performances, writing, and producing. As one of those, it was in the first wave of employees at DreamWorks Studios before the SKG Studios. Matt wore any hat that was necessary to help launch the feature film department. Yet his heart always personally attached to the prospect of having a say-so on what ultimately got on the screen. Consequently, writing has always been the secret sauce of having a voice that people would want to hear. Currently, Matt's responsibility is Director of Public Affairs North America West Area for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Involves developing relationships with opinion leaders for academia, business, government, religion, and public or privately maintained. Matt's work ultimately involves building bridges with those people and entities that might help or hinder the LDS Church. His goal is to help clarify the public positions, demystify folklore, understand doctrine, and help introduce Mormon phenomenon to positive mainstream awareness. In his spare time, if you don't find Matt with his family, he might be at the movie theater or on his road bike or mountain bike cycling for the sheer love of it. Matt has been married for 37 years and a father of 7 children. With that, we'd like to welcome Matt Ball.
Did you want me to put this on, Andy?
No.
Okay, here we go. Hey, good morning to you. Thanks very much for having me here. This is a sweet treat. Just if I can put this here with that. Maybe too lost it. Okay. Got a couple of fun things to share. Just to give you a little background on who I am. That's a little highfalutin. The North America West area is simply California and Hawaii for the LDS Church. And so my responsibilities as a public affairs director here are strictly to create relationships with opinion leaders. And the reason for that is because anytime the church has an initiative or any kind of interest in meeting with or creating a relationship with or having some sort of association with an organization or an entity or an individual, they're looking for someone to bridge that gap and to be able to make that association or make that connection for us. So if it's not me, it's individual regional leaders over those areas here in California and Hawaii with whom I have a relationship. And so we try to continually create associations with people. So that's my job. It's shaking hands and kissing babies all day. It seems like that, but it's not. But the great thing about my job is that I get to make it up every day. And that's probably the coolest thing about the film industry, is that it's never the same 2 days in a row, ever. And anytime you walk on the set or you're in a project or anything, it's brand new every day. So you never know what it's going to cost, what it's going to be, who the people associated with it. It's always different. And so that's one of the greatest attractions for me. So for me, it began for me back when I was actually a young kid telling stories. And so I would see a movie, and after seeing a movie, I would say, oh, have you seen this film? This is the greatest film. So I'd sit down and I'd start to tell a friend about this, and he'd say, oh, hey, you need to tell this guy about what you saw. And then pretty soon I'd have 5 guys sitting down in front of me listening to a film that I just saw. And then they'd go and see the film, and they'd come back, and they'd kill me. They're like, you totally wrecked that film. It was so much better in my mind. And I went and saw this film, and it was just boring. It was nothing. And I'm like, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. So I always say, spoiler alert, if you don't want to hear this, just don't listen or I won't tell you. So it was me always telling stories as a kid, and very unintentionally, just wanting to relate stories. And as a result, when I got to college, it was the same thing. It was sitting in a dorm room, and I would always, it was just hilarious, because between the distance between Provo, Utah, and Salt Lake is only 45 miles, so it's not a big drive. In California, that's like, yeah, that's my morning commute. So when I would be at a movie or going to a movie, I'm like, hey, I'm going to Salt Lake to see a movie. Anybody want to come? And they're like, where are you going to stay the night? I'm like, you guys are from Utah. And there wasn't a lot of commerce between Provo and Salt Lake at that time. So I was a freshman in 75. So back then, it was hilarious to go, really, I'm just coming back tonight. It's okay. But they're like, why go to Salt Lake? And I go, because if I want to see a film, I'm going to see it the way it was intended to be seen. So I'm going to see it in CinemaScope, the biggest screen possible. And I'm always going to sit closer to the screen than the screen is tall. So however the screen is like this, the trick is to always sit. If you take that and just lay it out in front of the screen, they always sit within that distance, within that width of the screen. And the reason for that is because the impact on your body means that your senses and your physical senses do not have any distinguishing ability to determine whether that's a real experience or not a real experience. So viscerally, your body perceives it as real. So I always like to sit close enough to where my wife goes, really? Are we sitting in the fifth row again? I'm like, no, this is how you feel the movie. She's like, I just am with you, okay? So fortunately, my wife and I met because we were in musical theater together. And I was a dancer back in the day. As a matter of fact, in college, I was a dancer. I danced before that very unexpectedly when my sister said, hey, listen, I need you to come with me. When I was 14, she said, I need you to come with me to a dance audition. And I'm like, I am not going with you to a dance audition. She said, it's kind of ballet, it's kind of jazz, it's kind of this thing, and there's a specialty dance, and we're going to tour all over. I'm like, you'll have to kill me before you drag me to a dance audition. I'm not doing this. And so she goes, how many times do I drag you along with all my friends and do everything with me? So I'm like, fine, I'll go with her. So anybody seen A Chorus Line?
Sure.
So you know the song, I Can Do That? Grab the shoes and seconds fall. Anyway, it's all about the fact that his sister couldn't make it to dance class one day, and he takes her place. So we go to this dance thing, and she does not make the team. She does not make the thing. And we're walking out, and as we're walking out, I get tapped on the shoulder. And it's like, excuse me, would you mind staying? We need a guy dancer to be with our girls. So I ended up touring Hawaii, touring all over California, and so my sister hates me for this. But I was only 4'11" at the time. But because of being so small, and I was always kind of in sports, so as a result of that, dance kind of became my entree into the whole entertainment world. And so as a result of that, I started to take dance at the Northern California. I got to take dance to where I finally was with a guy that was putting dancers on Broadway. And I didn't know that at the time. So we started to dance along, and I said, well, I'm going on a mission. So I'm headed out. Well, I came back to my mission, and all I ever wanted to do was play football, but I wasn't tall enough. So I was going to be a strong side safety on the team, and I was going to walk on to BYU and be a football player. And I got tall enough. I finally got to be 6 feet tall where I could see over the line, and I'm like, maybe I'll go try this quarterback thing. Well, in the off season at BYU, I go, I just got to get back in shape to make sure I'm there, so I went and took a dance class. The guy I took a dance class from was so ridiculously in shape that just to warm up, he would do at least 500 push-ups in all different forms, on his thumbs, in a triangle, wide, he would do it in every way. Then we'd go run up to the top of the Y with plastic bags on, then he would do weightlifting with small weight, multiple reps. He was incredibly ripped. I could see him. He could pick up any girl that he was dancing with, and he was only 5'9", and he could hold any girl with one hand above his head and talk to you while he's holding her. And this guy was such an incredible physical specimen. I'm like, wow, this guy's amazing. So I said, can I just work out with you and follow you around? So I worked out with him to the point where as I'm working out with him, he says, listen, I'm going on tour this summer. Would you like to go with me? I'm like, well, sure. So I went on tour, and that overlapped any kind of tryout for football. So instead of trying out for football, I'm out on tour doing a show on the East Coast with him, and that's where I met my wife. She was on tour at the same time. She was the lead in the show. We traveled all over and did this. So the very first touring company of Saturday's Warrior way back in the day, the first time I went to the East Coast, that's where my wife and I met. And then after that, we came back and did just a whole lot of shows. So while I was at BYU going to college, an undergraduate, I did Sundance Theater. So I was up there at Sundance doing Shenandoah, doing Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, and then we did Pippin. We did a whole lot of shows when I was at school. So while I was there, though, I was kind of infatuated with television, and so I got a job, very unintentionally, at BYU Master Control Operations. So I became a Master Control Operator from like 6 to 9 in the morning, 6 to 10 in the morning. Then I'd go to class and come back, and then I'd dance in the evening. And my wife, in the meantime, she'd be working also and going to school. So we were really pushing their schedules like crazy doing all this. But in the midst of all of this, Footloose came to town from Paramount Pictures, and I auditioned for Footloose and made this movie. It was a crazy thing. That's a whole other story, but the short story to that is I almost got arrested doing it. So, but in the process of almost getting arrested and almost getting kicked out of that audition, the choreographer saw me and said, you stay, we want you on the team. So I was a dancer for Footloose. So that's what got me into the business, was very accidentally just being a dancer that my sister tried to invite me to a dance thing one day that I hated her for. So getting into the business unintentionally, I just kept telling stories to all my roommates in college. And in doing this, when we had a chance to get into film, into the whole film business, I graduated from BYU and said, okay, I just need to make movies. I can make them here at BYU, or I can make them in LA, so let's go to LA. Well, for those of you the biblical story of Rachel and Leah, and what Joseph had to do to pay the price, that's what I had to do. So I had to go to Colorado and work my 7 years to work in my father-in-law's business with my wife in construction and development. So that's what I was doing. And the reason for that was because I was raised on a farm in the summers and the winters. My mom and dad had a farm up in Eugene, just outside of Eugene, Oregon. And outside of Eugene, Oregon, we had a cherry farm and holly farm. So we would spend our summers up there harvesting hollies and cherry. And So I had spent all the summers and winters up there, and so my father-in-law knew I had some experience with instruction, with hard work, and he required all of us to take architecture during high school. So by the time I was out of high school, I was a third-year architect, and I could read plans and follow plans and build from plans, and so he wanted me in construction. I'm like, great, I'm a dancer, I'm in communications, I'm in theater, and now I'm going to go work construction. So I did that for 7 years, and while I was working in construction, the only way I could hang on to any sort of semblance of life and what I would hope that I would ever accomplish any of my goals and dreams would be to start writing. And I figured if I had to work construction, I could just write and try to maintain some connection to the film industry this way. So I started to write TV shows, and it was for all the existing TV shows that were on the air at the time, from MASH to WKRP to Cosby to 30-something. I just kept writing spec scripts all the time and sending them until finally I got a call from a television show, 30-something, that said, we want you to write that for our show. And a friend of mine in L.A. said, my friend, nobody gets called from a production company to write a spec script from living in Colorado, sending in this. Nobody gets called. So whatever you're doing, stop your life and write that script because your life just got made. I don't know how you did that, so make that happen. So, and by the way, that happened when I sent in, I was so upset one day, I just sent in an idea to them and I said, listen, consider this my official release to you that I do not want to trouble you with any legal concern here. Here's an idea. I love your show. I love your characters. I love your stuff. Here's an idea. If you want it, take it. If not, throw it away. It doesn't matter what you want to do. So they called me and said, no, we want you to write that. Do that. So my father-in-law came to me the very next day and said, guess what? We now have the largest truck stop contract for building Sapp Brothers contracts out in the middle of Nebraska. As of tomorrow, you, me, on a pad of dirt in Nebraska, we're gone. Like, really? This happens to me so much. This happened with two other shows. In the meantime, so I went out to Nebraska and tried to write this show. What should have taken me no less than 5 days took me a month. And then I turned in my script, called 30-something, and I said, okay, here's who I am. Here's the script. Here's what's going on. And they go, what's your name again? Oh, sorry. We had to assign that out because we just needed that script sooner. And the show's going off the air. We just got canceled. So this is the last season. And yours was going to be the last script, one of the last scripts of the season. So love you, mean it. And I go, that's it. My father-in-law says, why don't you just be a partner with me in the company? And my wife goes, nope, we're leaving Colorado, we're going to LA. And I'm like, for what? So she took my script, sent it into the AFI, and I got accepted to the graduate program at AFI. And I came down to AFI, and while I was at AFI, I was so concerned because we were doing 15-hour days at AFI. And while I was there, I was like, I am never, ever going to see the light of day for my family or anything else because it's so intense here. And I was so concerned because we sold our house in Colorado and just lived on our equity. So when we moved from Colorado in 1990, we had $42,000 in our pocket. And I'm like, okay, I can last a year with four kids in L.A. without it. See, so I thought this from Colorado, right? I can make it $42,000 in a year. This is a cakewalk. So I get to L.A. and I'm thinking, I'm going to work for an entire year and not have to do anything but go to school. That's all I'm going to do. And my wife doesn't have to work with our four kids. It's going to be great. So to sustain ourselves, because we were both worried about that $42,000 disappearing in about 3 months here, we went ahead and said, we found a gasoline survey company. You know, the Lundberg survey company. Have you ever heard of Lundberg? So I had a connection through Lundberg, and Lundberg hired me to do gasoline surveys. So then, because I write with a writing partner who used to be my missionary companion back in the 70s, he was down here going to school a year before me. So my wife and I and my companion all got gasoline surveys. So in the morning at 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock, almost 6 to 9 every single morning, we'd get in the car with a little dictaphone, and we would drive all over the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles. We each had about 100 gas stations apiece. And we would drive all of those routes. We'd map it out. You'd get all the gas stations. You go, yeah, Roscoe and Victory, Shell Station, 25, 35, 45, 25, 35, 45. And so we do this into a dictaphone. And the whole time we did that, you do 100 stations like that, we get a dollar a station. So the entire time in L.A., we got to know every single street there was, from San Fernando Valley to South L.A., we knew everything. And in the process of that, this became our writing time. So my partner and I wrote in the car the whole time we were doing it because we were trying to sustain ourselves in our graduate program there, writing it. So in the car writing, we'd be like, all right, so the character's defining moment is, hold on, 34, 35, 45, Shell Station Victory. All right, so go ahead again. So we do, and then you get back home and you take all the dictation off of your dictaphone or your little recorder, and we write down all the gas station prices and call it in. So we get a dollar a station a day sustain ourselves while we're in grad school and doing this. So while I was in my second year of grad school, I was so concerned about how I was going to survive that a friend of mine said, listen, I hear they temp over at Disney, and they temp at DreamWorks. Not DreamWorks wasn't even established, but they temp at Disney. But there are specific temp agencies that align themselves with specific companies. So who do you want to work for? And I'm like, oh, I'd love to work for Disney. And they're like, okay, so go find this company. So I went in there, and they're like, you have a master's degree, and you want to temp. You want to do what? I'm going, I know, it's just, I'm 35, four kids. Nobody knows me in town. I got to do this. So I became a temp at Disney. And then I started to work in the legal department. And then after that, my very first job at Disney was signing Michael Eisner's name on all the letters that he was sending out for legal. There's a machine that has this double signature. You know, you sit there and write it. So I was writing Michael Eisner's name on 150 letters every hour. That was my job. And I went through pen after pen after pen. And then I'm like, okay, I hate this job. I hate my life. And then the next job was in the legal department. They're like, yeah, you're not a legal guy. You're definitely not a legal guy. I'm like, sorry. They said, you're a creative guy. Maybe you should go point at marketing. And so I would kind of wander around marketing, introduce myself, until finally somebody goes, you're a temp guy. I need a temp. So I ended up working over. And then somebody else says, hey. And I see this gal who's pregnant. And I said, so when are you having this baby? This looks like, is this your first baby? So we started to chat away. So she leaves for maternity leave, and I take her place in the marketing department. And my boss, my director, turns out to be Jeffrey Katzenberg's best friend. So any vacation that Jeffrey Katzenberg goes on, I turn out to be the guy that has to plan those vacations. Anything that we did for bar mitzvahs, bat mitzvahs, anything for film premieres, for special events projects, for anything. So my very first job on the studio lot at Disney was, okay, we're going to put an ice sculpture, it's a $25,000 ice sculpture in the fountain in Century City. And it's a big ice sculpture, so go get yourself a check from finance, go get that ice sculpture in the fountain, make sure it's ready for the premiere, and then set it up so the red carpet walks right by this ice sculpture of Beauty and the Beast. I'm like, really? That's it? And he goes, that's it. I said, how do I get $25,000? He said, just go down to finance and tell them you want it. And I'm like, I'm a temp. They'll kill me. And he said, if they don't give you a check, just tell them that Michael Eisner will write a personal check out of his account for this to get it done. And I'm like, they will hate me for this. And they go. So I learned that tchotchkes and swag was the way I survived. So in special projects, I had hats, t-shirts, sweatshirts, and we did special gifts. So I became the guy over gifting for all the executives in the studio. So as a result, I had a closet full of everything. So did anybody see Castaway with Tom Hanks? Remember he had a love of Elvis? He always had Elvis swag with him? That's how I lived. So I would go down to finance. You look like about a medium. Sweatshirts, hats. Oh, your kids. You got like four kids? I'd get them everything. So I'd get checks. I'd get everything I needed. I got all the stuff done in my office like snappy time. I'm like, swag is the way to go around here. This is cool. People will kill for a t-shirt. This is good stuff. So I learned how to do this. And in the process, I learned all the marketing heads and everybody, and so as we got to really, you know, just congeal here, the gal that came back on maternity leave found out that my boss, being Jeffrey Katzenberg's best friend, said, we're going to start a whole new company. We're going to go start this whole thing. Do you want to go? Because this gal does not want to leave Disney because of the maternity benefits and everything she's received here. So if you want to go, let's go. So with like eight of us over in a new studio in the Lakeside office, I went over there, and it's just us in an empty building. And he goes, set up the office, set up the building, set up the call structure, set up everything. You guys organize it from scratch. And I'm like, wow, this is crazy. So they said, you got to go to Amlin. You got to go work with Steven Spielberg. You got to go be in his office all the time. You're just going to talk with like eight people. And eight people became 35 people very quickly. And this is just all the top industry guys that they recruited into Amblin Entertainment, where Steven Spielberg had built his own little enclave over there on the Universal lot. And in this space, it's just like Fort Knox. You don't get in this place. But being with DreamWorks and being Jeffrey Katzenberg's second now, anything that I walked in there, they're like, hey, Mac, come on in. So I was like, wow. So DreamWorks, I mean, Amblin obviously provided you with full breakfast, full lunch. And if you were there late, we always had dinner. They always would feed us and everything, because it's an all whole philosophy here is we want you to talk business, do business, be business right here. And the thing you learn very fast about Steven Spielberg is that he was king in that anything associated with Spielberg was always about the fact that they knew that if things got tough and rough, he would make a film and get us out of trouble, or keep us out of trouble, or lead us in a place where we would never get into trouble. So Spielberg was always the guy. So when they decided to create DreamWorks Studios, these three guys got together, and here was, this is the dirty truth about the whole thing, is that when Katzenberg did not get the leading position at Disney Studios, when Michael Eisner lost his Frank Wells, and Frank Wells was, I think Frank was LDS. Anybody know Frank personally? I think Frank was LDS. But he was known for his adventurism in the world. He had climbed all of the tallest peaks in the world. he died on one of these adventures, and that position was open, and Katzenberg was the next man in line. He did not get that job. Michael Eisner gave it to David Ovitz, who was the guy that created the largest agency. You know, it was just this huge thing for Katzenberg not to get that job. So because he didn't get that job, he went and talked to David Geffen, you know, the billionaire from the music industry that got all of his money from the music industry, and then Spielberg, obviously a billionaire. So you've got two billionaires, and Katzenberg, who was the low man on the totem pole in terms of income, he went ahead and said, if we form a company together, we'll do animation, live action, and music, and then we'll also add video games, and we'll add a whole lot of other industry kind of stuff that we want to do, TV, TV animation, live action TV, live action features. It was just this huge, huge prospect of all of these things together, but it was going to be a creative haven for all of the artists to come together in a space where everybody could just really, really do like think tank imagineering and come up with stuff where we wouldn't have to produce 15 feature films a year, which is what studios have to do in order to survive and, you know, crack their nuts. So you'll always see a studio doing nowadays a big what they call tentpole picture. And a tentpole picture is like a Superman or a Wonder Woman or something that's going to make $500 million because it costs $150 million to make minimum. And at the time in which I started out, we were making films still for $25 to $50 million, which seems crazy money, of course. But in the film industry, the kind of money that we would spend to do special projects alone was so obscene and so absurd that I'm like, I can't even tell people the kind of money I spend. I was given assignments like, Matt, we want you to go in and get that that hotel room and those walls completely knocked out because Steven's got his family coming in and we want that to be their home while he's shooting this film. And they're going to have educators and school and everything going on here, but you got to make that their home. So this hotel has to be their home. So knock out the walls and make it all real for them. It's got to be just like home. You have 3 days to do it. And make sure the furnishings match their furnishings, make it like home. Can you do that? I'm like, of course I can. And the thing you learn, and I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea what to do. But within, you know, 1 minute, 10 minutes, 1 hour, 2 hours, you've got a Learjet carrying a refrigerator. You've got another plane carrying furniture. You've got contractors working 48 hours straight. And you've got a crew of 24 guys in a small space. And you're like, y'all do this, or I'll get somebody else to do it. I learned that I can get anything I want, anytime I want, any day, anywhere, for anything I can get it. And because I had an unlimited budget to do it, which is insane. It's just, it was obscene, the stuff that I was given the right and the opportunity to do. But it was just, I knew too much. They're like, this guy, he knows way too much. But the point was is that I would do anything. I said, as long as it's honest, as long as it's right, and as long as it's good, I'll do it for you. But if it's dishonest and it's not right, I won't do this. They're like, okay, so they said, do you have any problem working 24/7? And I'm like, you're working 24/7, so what's the problem? So I'd go fill up their cars. I would go get their laundry done. I would go do anything in their house that needed to be done to renovate, to fix their house. I would do all their pest control. I would do anything in their space. And it was a crazy time. And Spielberg was not my direct contact. Katzenberg was always my direct, it was my boss and then Katzenberg. So wherever they went, I was always one person away from Steven. So I would see him, he couldn't pick me out of a lineup today. So don't be mistaken. I mean, we're not chums, we're not friends. He would not ever consider me a bud. So nevertheless, he might go, I think I know you, or I think I do. But, you know, we would hold events everywhere and he would still not know me. To the extent where we're doing a premiere one night, and it's in the largest theater in downtown Westwood. And my boss, I always have a headphone in my ear, and we're doing special events to where we've got ushers up and down the aisles. We've got 1,200 people in this theater. We've got all the celebrities, and we always make sure that everybody's got assigned seating. So I know the seating chart because I create the seating chart. We sit in a room, and you sit there with everybody saying, Spielberg goes right there, and he goes there with his family, and everybody goes around him. And then you make sure to seat all the other celebrities around him. And then you seat everybody else outside of that. So my job was to make sure that that seating chart was done. My job was also to get all the invitations for that event done, make sure they were sent out. In addition to making sure all the Academy Award nominations, I had all the submissions for those applications done. So anything Spielberg did, I had to make sure that those applications were done for possible best director, best picture, best act, anything. I had to submit all that paperwork. And then I had to address all the Academy. But this sounds like a lot, but it was my boss who had this assignment. And then he would say, here, you do that. You just go do that. He goes, we need to approach and attach all of our invitations to the Academy. So why don't you go ahead and get the Academy list? The irony is you cannot get the Academy list from anybody. It doesn't exist. It's not public. So you have to find a way to get the Academy list and get every Academy member invited to everything you do because that's where all the voters are to give you recognition for what you're doing. So, sorry, I know our time is short. I'm trying to speed talk here because I know there's so much to tell you. But it was so fun because we'd be sitting in these events and my boss is in my ear and I get, you know, you get this blankety blank audience sitting down and you make sure that they're taken care of and you get this done. And I'm standing here with Stephen because I know I've got to walk him up to the podium to say a few words. And I'm like, Stephen, if you and I walk up here now, the audience will sit down and they will start. And he goes, well, no. I want to wait because their people are still seating and getting. I said, I know. They're very respectful of you, however. So when you come up, you're going to be, you'll command the room and they'll sit down. And my boss is like, what the frick is wrong? Get Stephen to the podium. What's the problem? Like, thank you very much. I appreciate that. So Stephen, and he's like swearing in my ear the whole time. And here I'm going, taking Stephen by the arm. And he's like, no, I don't. And I said, I promise it'll be okay. And he's like, I said, you don't need to know my name. Come with me. So we walk up to the podium. And as soon as we step up to the podium, I say, good evening. Welcome. I'd like to welcome Steven Spielberg. And the whole audience goes silent. And they all sit down. And he's like, it's all yours. So he starts to talk. And my boss goes, well, that just saved your job, buddy. And I'm getting this the whole time. I'm smiling going, go ahead, you talk. So again, he wouldn't pick me out of a crowd, but that was the kind of stuff we did all the time. So we'd see each other in the studios and do everything associated with this. But the thing that was really hard, and this is the dirty truth about DreamWorks, Steven Spielberg wanted to have the autonomy to make any film that he wanted to make, whatever he wanted to make, and the industry lets him do it. If his name is attached to anything, it's going to be a success. If he grandfathers in a project by having his name attached, then people know it's going to get traction. It's going to get golden. But the reality was is that he was over live action feature films at DreamWorks, and nobody could ever do a film unless it was greenlit by him. But the irony was is that he himself was not making DreamWorks films. So we at DreamWorks are like, well, you have this company, and everybody's going scattered directions, and you all want to do your own thing. Why aren't you all focused on making films for DreamWorks and doing films for DreamWorks? And if Spielberg would just do DreamWorks films, we'd be okay. So what's the problem? Well, a film would come along and he'd say, hey, I love that one. I'm going to go do that. I love this one. So he kept doing films for other studios. And maybe somewhere down the road, he would do a 50% distribution deal. So we'd get a piece of that. But DreamWorks would always get international distribution. That means we don't have control over what the brand appearance of that project looks like. So we did not have a say-so as to the marketing campaign that the rest of the world gets to have. So as a result, international would just be secondary income. And, you know, they'd say, well, this made $110 million domestically, but it made $160 million internationally. Well, there's so much money that goes back to Spielberg would take 27 cents on the dollar, every dollar. I mean, the gross dollar. So he would make all the money. And then if he had a star like Tom Cruise doing a film like Minority Report, between the two of them, they'd take 40% of the dollar. They would make $70 million on a film. The studios would make $25 million on a film. And DreamWorks would only get half of the credit for it because we were a part distributor on it and never domestic. So domestic, we never got U.S. credit for this stuff. So inside the studio, the frustration for us was like, just make a DreamWorks film. You can do anything. I mean, just to back up a little bit, Steven Spielberg is a great filmmaker, so I don't mean to disparage him in any way, but it was so big, and everybody, I don't want to say he surrounded himself with sycophants because he was so demanding and is so demanding on himself that he would never allow his own film to get past a certain place without running it through the most grueling test of whether or not the story works, and story is king. He is all about story, and so no matter how many special effects you see with other films like Transformers or any other superhero fight or whatever it is, that's not Spielberg's thing. The reason why is because he goes like, if the story doesn't tell it, it won't sell it. So story is king. No matter what you see, no matter what you do, it's all about story. So he is very, very demanding on story. And nothing gets out of the office or out of the studio without that being the number one priority. So for all of our frustrations for DreamWorks of him not producing films directly for us, only for us, and distributed by us, it was like, if you want the studio to succeed, just do this. But then he had this other crazy deal. And that was the two people that ran the studio, they were Walter and Laurie Parks. They were also producing the very films that we were developing. So they became executives that were administrating everything. And then they also wanted their hands on a piece of the action. So Men in Black, Catch Me If You Can, all these great big huge films, they were the producers of it and they were the studio executives. So in everybody else's eyes, we're like, that is a major conflict of interest. What are you doing? And so we felt as though from inside, DreamWorks was being deteriorated because there was no focus on just one thing, and that is DreamWorks projects, DreamWorks products, DreamWorks everything. And the irony is that by himself, Spielberg doesn't need the studio. He can function on his own and do everything on his own without any of this. I mean, just to back up again, Spielberg was born in 1946. He's 70 years old today. He's got seven kids. He's on his second marriage, but his second marriage is obviously where he's got all of his kids. He had one child from his first marriage, Max. But all of his kids and everybody are associated with the business, but not like him, of course. He's the man. But it's all about really, really telling a story. And his wife has to really relegate whether or not he is going to do another story. So she's like, okay, that's enough. You've done enough. We have to be careful with what you're doing here because there's so much. But so many fun things. I mean, when he did, I don't know if you knew this, but Steven Spielberg's dyslexic. They didn't even diagnose that until he was 60 years old. And he's such a visual guy. He went to Cal State Long Beach. And when he went to Long Beach, he, after his first year, y'all know the story of him, when he took the tour at Universal Studios, and by taking the tour, he ditched off of the tour and went into a restroom and waited for like 30 minutes. The tour went away, and he stayed on the lot, talked to people, and ended up staying there for 3 days. And then after that, he came back, and his whole summer vacation, he ended up sitting on the lot listening and talking to everybody in the studio until he made a short film called Amblin, a little six-minute film, a little kind of a tone poem that ended up being the film that got him a TV assignment. So he started to direct Night Gallery and all the stuff you see on television, Columbo, all those individual things. And then he got his first film assignment from that little tiny six-minute, seven-minute film he did, which was the TV show called Duel. And Duel with Dennis Weaver became not just a television hit, but it's the number one most watched television movie ever made. And they added another 15 minutes of footage to it so they could make it an international feature film and distribute it across the world because it was so unexpectedly a hit. Well, that film got him Jaws. And Jaws in 1975, well, he did Sugarland Express in 1974 because that was his first vision of what he wanted to do with Goldie Hawn and felt like, okay, he could really do something big here. And Sugarland Express was kind of a nominal success, but the next film, Jaws, that he did, he's 27 years old, and he thought, I got this, I can do this. I've made about 25 TV films and other things that he'd done building up to this point. And it was just amazing that he even got this gig. The fact that he turned in a six-minute film, they said, anybody that can do a six-minute film, clearly you've got the chutzpah and the ability to do this. But Steven goes, listen, the secret for me is always storytelling. And so whenever I'm shooting a film, I don't care what the camera does. He goes, I'm not a camera guy, but I'm a story guy. So what I want to do is I want to tell the story and then let the camera show me what it is that's going to best reveal that story. So he said, for me, story is king. And so when he would shoot something, he said, obviously I became a camera expert, but it's not because that's how I started. I started with story. And, you know, he's got this great philosophy. And the philosophy is, it's something that's so similar to us in Mormon doctrine. And for those of you that are aware of the scriptural reference in the Bible, in 1 Kings, it's actually Steven Spielberg's number one philosophy for what it is that he can do and what it is that you have to do in order to succeed in the film business. And he goes, it's simply this. He said, your dreams are whispers. They are not shouts. And he said, there is two things. Your conscience will tell you what you should do, and your intuition will tell you what you could do. And he goes, what I did and what I recommend everybody do is I would do what it is you can do or what you could do by virtue of your intuition. So he said, but that comes to you in such a subtle, small whisper. It's never a shout. It's always a very quiet thing, and you have to listen closely. And if you're fortunate enough to find something, a niche, which allows you to express yourself through that particular intuitive thing, then you're able to do things to fulfill your dreams. And so he said, it's a shout. And I thought of this, and I think of this all the time. And it's in 1 Kings chapter 19 where it says, and after the earthquake, well, this is the Lord talking to Elisha. And he says, and behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains and break in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after a fire, a still, small voice. That's the way we know our God communicates with us, is very, very quietly. And that's exactly the philosophy that Steven Spielberg says, is the way in which you can know what you have to do with all the things you're choosing. He says, even when you're standing there, when he's doing Raiders of the Lost Ark, and he's surrounded by massive equipment and massive amounts of people, and all of a sudden he goes, oh, I'm just blank. And he goes, I have to just sit there and stop so I can hear that inner voice and know what it is I'm supposed to do. And he says, and then when I allow myself that moment to ponder without any interruption, then I'm like, okay, now I can do this. And he says, and of course, in the film business, everybody does everything they do with surety. and with confidence and with this demeanor of I know exactly what I'm doing, and nobody knows what they're doing. Nobody does. It's a complete guess. The only thing is that it's a pretty good guess because they keep repeating it over and over. Now, Spielberg, I don't know if you know this, but he has done all of his films cumulatively have done over $9 billion over all the years. Not to mention individual films. They're just crazy, but he's got his pet projects. But I'm just going to give them to you in alphabetical order. He's got over 40 films that he personally has directed, but he's got hundreds of material, hundreds of projects that he has produced, executive produced, written. I mean, it's like the movie Poltergeist. Anybody seen Poltergeist way back in the day? Even though there's another man that's credited for that film, we in the business know that that man was fired. He was the one that did Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Tobe Hooper. And Tobe was fired from that job. Spielberg was standing over his shoulder. He ended up directing it, but Tobe Hooper got credit for it, for directing it. But we all know Spielberg directed it. And he wrote the thing. So you're like, wow, that's kind of amazing stuff. Well, he did that kind of stuff all the time when he was sitting on your shoulder. And he saw that if he was executive producing and that was not working, you can count on him doing it. So when you get into a meeting with him, he's like, listen, I recommend a couple of things. Like when Sam Mendes came into DreamWorks and he was doing American Beauty, for which we won Best Picture at DreamWorks Studios, he's like, listen, I would hold the camera here longer. When you want to communicate what that person is thinking, drive the camera in quickly and fast and let the surroundings suddenly pull around you, but let it just be right on that face so you get the reaction of the face. And Sam Mendes is like, well, that's if you were directing it. That's what we would do. So he says, either you trust me to direct this or you don't. Spielberg would say, okay, you're the guy. Go ahead. So he would allow the directors to direct their films when they were doing them. But if the film was going south and we saw that it was going south, everybody in the studio would say, you got to do this. You got to pick this up. If you don't, we're dead. So he would do that on more occasions than not. And there was a lot of controversial films. And when you saw this top 10, if you were looking at this at all, I mean, I was there when we were doing the campaigns for Saving Private Ryan, Gladiator, American Beauty. All of those films were kind of our top things. And DreamWorks was set up to be, we all say it's a little bit snobbish, but we were set up to be a film that it was all Academy Award kind of quality films. And anything that was less than that, I don't want to say Road Trip, but even Old School. It was just kind of, college frat humor. It was a little bit below what DreamWorks felt like they were trying to accomplish. DreamWorks always was trying to elevate themselves to let's do Academy Award stuff all the time. And whenever a story didn't work out, they'd go, what do we do? And they'd panic, and they'd get some sort of development executive to go ahead and say, okay, let's just do the White House. Let's just do Biker Boys. Let's do something else. And so as a result, a lot of guys lost their jobs for putting those films out there because they weren't Academy Award material. So DreamWorks had this reputation for wanting to do Academy Award material, trying to do Academy Award material, but Steven Spielberg was doing Academy Award material with every other studio. We're like, well, are we together on this or not? So we were a little bit frustrated by that. And that doesn't take away from his filmmaking ability at all, because he was masterful, just totally masterful. He said, when I was a young guy, he said, the coolest thing about being what I got a chance to do was I directed my first film before I was 21 years, when I was 21 years of age. I mean, who gets that? Nobody gets that. So he goes, but because I had done those television movies and built up to it, all of my escapist films that I did during my early career were things that I probably wouldn't do today. Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Anybody seen this movie? You know what this movie is about? So he said today he could not do that film. And the reason why he couldn't do that film is because it means leaving your family and leaving them all behind. And he says, it's the scriptural reference that says, once you know what you're supposed to do, you leave plow and family. You just leave the plow in the field and you go do what you have to do. He said, that's what I'm basing it on. But the reality is, he said, I couldn't do that today because that would mean leaving my family, and I just couldn't do that. But that whole film, he said, it's okay. That whole escapist genre that I was working in, that's when I knew exactly what I wanted to do. But I just didn't know who I was. He said, I'm not going to take away from any of those things. I'm not going to take away from what I did. But I knew that who I was something that was developing and evolving. And he said, after I did Jaws, I could basically do any film I wanted to. They wrote me a check for everything. So Spielberg has never had to use his own money to make any of his films. Not since Amblin, not since the very, very first six-minute film. Since that time, studios handed him everything because story is king, and he will not let those films get done and developed unless story is right. So even though he may miss on some of the perfect things that happen, ultimately, he's the cutting-edge director, and he's the one that's considered the director of our day and age. So when Obama gave him the highest medal that you could receive as a citizen last year, along with 17 other people in the United States, and then he spoke at Harvard last year, you might know that he received an honorary doctorate of arts at Harvard University last year, and he gave the commencement speech there. And during his commencement speech, he talked about all of the great things that you would do or that you should do to get in the business. And obviously it's working hard. You have to be so impassioned that it just drives you. You're driven so that you can be up all night and not even realize you're up all night. And he said, if you don't always feel this way right now, you can't get here. So like I was telling Bruce earlier, when people would come into the business and come into LA and they'd say, so I want to get in the business. How do you get in the business? We're like, ah, oh, it's too late. If you're asking that question, you can't get into business. You don't even know better than to not ever ask that question, because there's never a direct path. There's never a direct road. Every single person's story is different, and the way everybody gets in is completely different, because the world has changed so much today now. Social media, what DreamWorks came up with back in the day was pop.com. And pop.com never got off square one. But pop.com is what YouTube is today. And DreamWorks had that completely envisioned. Ron Howard, that was his brainchild. Ron Howard was going to be a part of the family at DreamWorks, but it never materialized because they couldn't put it all together, because the creatives were not businessmen, businesswomen. They were creatives. And so they were always developing story and trying to be story-oriented, but they didn't have the bean counters and the businessmen to really keep everybody in line. And Katzenberg was a total businessman. And the greatest challenge of all of that we were doing at DreamWorks was trying to balance Katzenberg thinking that he had a creative ability to make things go, and then failure after failure after failure on the animation side led to almost the complete demise, to where finally DreamWorks was sold off. Animation was cut off separately, then we were sold off to Paramount, then we divided up, and so now Spielberg's doing his own thing, Geffen's doing his own thing, and Katzenberg still has a say-so out there trying to do animation. And so DreamWorks is a name, and some of those people are still associated. And if you were fortunate enough to work at the campus, because I was on that pad of dirt when it was a pad of dirt, and it was Spielberg, Katzenberg, and Geffen standing right there, and they said, okay, this is going to be a creative think tank where everybody lives together and works together in the same place at the same time. And everything that we do out of here is stemmed from a camaraderie that our ideas get, you know, spread to everywhere, and everything right here within this place. So you can think of it, develop it, create it, sell it, produce it, do it all right here. And that was the goal and the dream. And when those successes and those stories did not sell, suddenly it became like every other studio and all got sold off. And then it's like the lowest common denominator becomes the thing they're looking for money. So it's a horror film. It's a cheap trick. It's whatever it takes to get there. And so we're like, ah, such a bummer, because the demographic that buys that garbage is really the 18 to 24-year-old market. And so when they appeal to that market, we're like, dang. And Spielberg goes, yeah, that's not who I'm appealing to. But a little piece of trivia that's fun before I stop. Spielberg, as you may or may not know, he said, I do not make R-rated films. That's not what I do. The reason I don't is because, number one, I have a family. I want my kids to see my films. But the number two reason is because anything below an R-rated makes all the money in the world. So we're all about keeping ourselves alive here. So the only time he made an R-rated movie, Schindler's List, when he stepped up and said, well, it was actually before Schindler's List, when he made a movie and they said, yeah, because of the violence in this movie, we have to give it an R rating. He said, that's not an R-rated movie. And they said, yeah, it's an R-rated movie. And he says, no, it's not. It's not an R-rated movie. And they go, well, so what do you propose? And he goes, I propose a new rating system, a PG-13. So Steven Spielberg is the one that got that PG-13 created, because his film, he did not want an R rating on it. So it stopped being a problem for everybody else in the business. So when those warning signs for your children came up on the screen, that PG-13 was because Spielberg never wanted an R-rated rating on his film until Schindler's List, and then Munich, because it was such a political film that was so violent. So anyway, so much more to tell you, but ultimately, Spielberg is still considered storyteller and the greatest filmmaker of our lifetime and of our day. Better than Hitchcock, better than John Ford, better than, you know, all the guys. I mean, David Lean, the Lawrence of Arabia, he is still considered the man. And his film library is so huge that if you're fortunate enough to get in that family, then he trusts you implicitly, and he's all about stories. So it's a magnificent thing. But he's always saying those same two things I told you earlier, and that is, it's all about what you should do versus what you can do. And let's see, his next film that he's going to produce, I think it's going to be The Papers. Papers is right now, so you'll see that as probably his next film.
What's it about?
I don't know The Papers, as a matter of fact. I just saw, it's Meryl Streep's in it, and I want to say Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep are in it, but I just saw it and was just reviewing it, but I don't know what's in this film. But nevertheless, I have since left DreamWorks, and everybody says to me, I left to go produce my own film. And the irony is because somebody came to me and said, well, what gives you the right to tell me that my film doesn't work here? Because they put me into development to where you could have a say-so as to what goes on the screens. And so we created a smaller division in DreamWorks called Go Fish Pictures. And Spielberg said, okay, so if we're not going to make these big epic pictures, let's make a film that's less than $3 million. And any film for less than $3 million, let's put it in Go Fish Pictures. So Go Fish became our small independent label. And I'm like, I want to be on that label. I want to be the guy that helps decide what goes on that screen. Let me start there. Let me be that guy. And they had no idea who I was. So I started to watch films on the weekends and the nights and recommend films until finally we came back and said, yep, this is what we want to do. And then they saw that we started to recommend films. And one guy came to me, Ricky Schroeder came to me, and I turned him down. Said no, and he says, what gives you the right to turn me down? Who are you? And I'm like, this is what I do for my work. I've been here a long time. I've been here 10 years. This is what I do. And he goes, well, what have you written? What gives you the right to tell me this is no good? And I'm like, I read scripts all day long. I see films all day long. I'm a cinemaniac. This is what I do. And he's like, prove it. And I'm like, I don't have to prove it. I've got this job. That's where I prove it. And he goes, have you ever written a thing in your life? I'm like, of course I have. And he goes, show me. So I'm like, I'm not on trial here. Your film's not going to go through DreamWorks. It's not happening. And he says, what if I have these two singers sing on this thing? And what if I have this actor in this thing? And I said, if that's true, then we can market it based upon them, but it's going to be a limited release. It's going to be in this place. And so he didn't like me because I was telling him all the conditions he had to have. And so finally I said, we got to know each other. And then we got to be a little bit friendly. So I finally handed him a script. I said, here, now I'll give it to you because now you're not asking for it. So I gave him a script that I wrote. He goes, so what are you doing with this? I'm like, it's just something I have. It's just something I love. It's my thing. So while I was at DreamWorks, I got nominated for a writing award for the Humanitas Award for ABC. And did a Universal, remember Vin Diesel? You know Vin Diesel? Vin Diesel's very first film project that he did for Universal Television was Knight Rider 2000. So that's what I wrote for, was Knight Rider 2000. Then for Disney. And then on this particular feature, Rick Schroeder said, what if I direct that for you? So I said, sure. So we had Gwyneth Paltrow and Matt Fox from Lost, and I left the studio to go produce my own film and go do that. And at $60 million budget, we were on our way, and everything fell out of bed. And I was sitting there going, wow, my life is dead. My wife's going to kill me. She turned around and got a master's degree at Pepperdine within 1 year and saved our bacon. And while she did that, I got part-time jobs painting houses again. I was like doing construction again. Until finally the church says, come with me. And they asked me to come and be their guy in public affairs. And I just laughed. I'm like, I don't think you want me. I'm a film guy. I'm an entertainment industry. And they said, no, we want to be in the entertainment industry too. So the church asked me to come along and do this thing for them. And we have more fun because now we just finished a film for public affairs. It's going to be on faithcounts.com. We just finished it last week, and we're about to do another film. So I ended up writing films for the church. We ended up doing all of the things that I did in the entertainment industry, we ended up doing exactly in public affairs, which is hilarious to me because I'm like, wow, who ever thunk this? That was crazy. But the reality is that show that I didn't do with Ricky Schroeder, Tom knows this because he's heard it. We turned that show into a musical, and we're working to get that to Broadway right now. So we're just on the side. We have a whole musical we're doing. So in my other life, we're still doing that. But in the meantime, public affairs is where we get to express all this stuff. And it's the influence of Steven Spielberg is resonates in my head every single day. So I hope that gives you a sense for what's going on. But I know we can talk. I can keep going here. We got another couple hours we can talk about this. So I apologize to keep you so long, but thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.